From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1680 in Holland, where a Dutch naturalist named Anton van Leeuwenhoek, I think, was the first to microscopically observe yeast. But he wasn't convinced yeast was a living organism, saying that he had found them instead to be just globular structures. That was not giving yeast nearly enough credit. For the next several hundred years, researchers would debate yeast whether it was algae or fungi, and then its role in bread. And that's logical. You've got bread, you've got beer, you know those things. Those are important things. But you might not be aware of just how important yeast has become to scientific research far beyond brioche and IPAs. This hour, it's our monthly science roundtable, and we're starting with a question. Would you rather live longer? Would you rather live healthier? And what does yeast have to do with it? Let me put it this way. The naked mole rat has some competition for unlikely lab MVP. And let me go ahead and welcome our guests for the hour. David Goldfarb is here, professor of biology at the University of Rochester. Professor, nice to have you.
Thank you, Evan.
And Gregory Tomblin's here, research associate in the Department of Biology at the University of Rochester. Greg, nice to have you as well.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
What's yeast got to do with it? It's a great place to start because we are going to talk about very important questions, I think, to everyone listening. Aging. Fighting aging and all of these processes that play out and how we can create therapies and drugs to work with that. But let's start with why yeast. David, why yeast?
Well, it's a good question. I'd like to answer that a few ways. First of all, what is yeast as an organism? And then how is yeast similar to humans? So we can think...
See, that's like the least likely question that I would jump to. What is yeast? It's not just globular structures, as they thought in 1680. We do know that. But similar to humans is not where I would go next.
Good. Well, we'll go there.
Okay.
And then maybe I can talk just a minute or two about the utility of yeast for basic and medical research.
Absolutely. Well, let's start with what it is then. Go ahead.
Okay. So yeast is what we call a eukaryotic organism. We are eukaryotic organisms. Plants are eukaryotic organisms. Yeast is a single cell. Eukaryotic organism, and yeast is evolutionarily more closely related to animals like us than it is to plants. Of course, yeast has a very healthy, robust lifestyle. It lives on fruits, we think, and in the soil, and eats the same thing on probably a vegetarian diet that we eat. It has a much, much smaller genome than ours. It has a sex life. It has two sexes and divides and replicates much like we do. An interesting recent study showed that if you take 400 human genes and replace those 400 yeast genes with those human genes, then over 50% of those genes function perfectly well in yeast. So physiologically, yeast metabolizes food, divides, grows, responds to the environment in many of the same ways as humans do. And the reason for this is that it shares many of the same genes as humans. You can take 200 of these human genes, which are essential for life in humans and essential for life in yeast, and replace the yeast genes with the human genes, and they work perfectly well. So we can use yeast as a model to study the functions of those genes in a eukaryotic organism. And then I might just add that again, you mentioned up front that yeast is used obviously for brewing, for beer and wine and bread. But yeast is a very important, what we call a model system, an alternative to studying basic biology and medical questions in humans. We can use yeast to study biomedical questions. Yeast is also an important industrial organism, and it's an important biotech organism for the production of commercially valuable and medically valuable materials. So that's a short list of what yeast is.
Greg, you anything to add there?
Sure. I would like to add something. One thing is, I don't mean to correct you, but
there's two scientists on this panel. I'm not one of them, but go ahead.
I think it's really cool. They published in Science, I think, a review of how far back yeast dates in human history as a useful thing. And we know it makes beer and bread, but so they were able to find it in archaeological pots, evidence of yeast that are like 9,000 years old. So I think it's been shaping society, and people have been using it as a tool. And I think part of the reason was is that when yeast ferments, it can create alcohol. And it was actually probably safer than water to drink, the alcoholic beverage. So that harks back to the idea that yeast is a tool for us. And it's probably one of the main reasons why we use it is that it's efficient and it's easy to manipulate and in a cost-efficient way. And like David said, we all sort of eat things. Yeast eat things. And we break things down. If you think of like food, like a complex Lego assembly, which then has to be broken down to different smaller pieces of Legos. And then the cell takes those pieces and then builds it up into different things that it needs. Well, a lot of the core machinery that does that in yeast is very similar to what human cells have. And there are some differences as metabolism gets more complicated. And then the other thing is that yeast, we have such a history of working with yeast that we have many strains. And so the definition of a strain is that there's number of different isolates where genetically they're just slightly different and they have defined characteristics that we have in the freezer. And so yeast has like 6,000 genes roughly. And we have strains in the freezer where many of them are mutated individually. That is that they're knocked out. The strain doesn't have them. So we can use that as a tool, as a reference point for our studies.
And speaking of what yeast eats, when yeast eats sugar in winemaking, that creates the alcohol, right? That's the process, right?
Right. So this is a good place to start about how yeast is really a useful tool for studying human biology. So when we eat sugar, any carbohydrate, one of the first pathways, metabolic pathways that we process sugar through is called glycolysis. And bacteria, most organisms on the planet use glycolysis to burn sugar to get energy out of it. But when you finish with glycolysis, then the end product of glycolysis in humans and animals and plants is shifted over to an intracellular organelle called the mitochondrion, which is the powerhouse of the cell. And it takes the byproducts of glycolysis, broken down sugar, and burns it very, very efficiently and produces a lot of energy. So there's two basic pathways for using sugar and other proteins and lipids in yeast and in our cells, glycolysis and then this other mitochondrial pathway. The cool thing about yeast is that the mitochondrial pathway is dispensable. So animals cannot live without mitochondria. You can't work with, it's very, very difficult. I think it's safe to say you almost can't work with animal cells that lack mitochondria. But you can work with yeast cells that lack mitochondria. So you can then very carefully and specifically dissect how mitochondria function in yeast, because if you screw it up, you're not going to kill the organism you're studying. So, for example, there's a researcher in the biology department, Elaine Sia, that studies mitochondrial DNA metabolism, and she can work with yeast that have or don't have mitochondria or parts of mitochondria and understand what are the essential and non-essential functions of mitochondria in yeast. And because many of those genes also operate in humans, understand human biology by using that special trick that yeast uses and only having and being able to survive only with glycolysis.
This is where there is, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, guys, this is where this is an interesting and probably an advantageous pivot for scientists, because you don't have to have those ethical considerations that if yeast dies, yeast dies. If you want to, in other words, if you want to study for the creation of therapies and drugs, et cetera, and you're studying something that is, I guess, a human or even other animals, et cetera, you have to create different ethical considerations versus if you're studying yeast. Is that fair? Yes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're almost, Greg may want to talk about this in a little bit more depth, but we don't really see any ethical issues in growing and killing this fungus,
right?
This yeast. So we can use it for however we wish to use it. Whereas, one of the main reasons why yeast is a very good model system, instead of having to use mice or monkeys or dogs or sheep or goats or rabbits to study fundamental core processes that yeast share with humans. Why not do the work in yeast, understand what the parts of the puzzle, what the pieces of the machine are, and then that will instruct others to do work in higher cells where it becomes not only expensive and difficult and costly, but people have major, and many, most scientists do as well, have major ethical concerns with working with mammalian systems.
Absolutely, Greg.
Right. So I think an excellent point, what I think David sort of addressed, is that it allows you to cut to the chase. So maybe instead of doing 100 experiments with animals and various permutations, you could do those 100 type of question and answer series with yeast, and then maybe zero in on the one experiment that is really going to tell you something in the animal studies. And then you know, it becomes an ethical savings then to then go to an animal and say, we already suspect this is going to be the case. Let's test it instead of testing those 100 things.
But there have to be, well, there don't have to be. There don't have to be anything. But in my mind, I'm thinking there have to be limitations when you're studying yeast versus studying a mammal.
Sure.
You know, as much as there are similarities, where do you bump into that wall that you can't be sure of?
Well, we bump into that wall all the time. There's certain questions you can address using yeast, and there's certain questions you can't address using yeast. And we address the questions you can address using yeast.
What's an example?
An example, is our use of yeast to identify drugs that may treat age-associated diseases in humans. I think any basic system which is conserved between yeast and humans can be studied first in yeast. Now, yeast don't have brains, they don't have bones, we don't have kidneys, we don't have the hormonal systems, but there's a lot of biology in there that is shared, and those aspects of yeast biology are the ones that we can study in yeast, obviously. And there's some major cell biological questions that we still know very little about, where yeast is leading the way.
Greg?
Right. I think so David highlighted some of the different systems, and I think he touched on one like metabolism systems, like breakdown of sugar pathways. Another major one that we found maybe holds some similarities to humans is DNA metabolism genes. So both yeast and higher cells and our cells, human cells, have to replicate their DNA, and they have to do it efficiently and faithfully. And yeast also have to do that. And there's a lot of conservation in those types of mechanisms that we can study.
And numerous diseases of humans are caused by dysfunction of those particular processes.
We're talking to David Goldfarb and Greg Tomblin from the University of Rochester about, I said, you know, move over naked mole rat for the unlikely MVP of the lab, because the naked mole rat's gotten all kinds of attention for the great work that we've been able to learn from it. But yeast is not something, me not being a scientist, that I would have expected to hear is so, so valuable to people like David and Greg when they look at how to help combat aging. And let me go ahead and just read something here briefly. And I want David and Greg to expand on this, because when we talk about combating aging through working with something like yeast, well, you know, you have the chance of maybe actually slowing the aging process, or decreasing, or learning how. David, what you said was that the goal is to maybe slow the aging process, not necessarily to expand the lifespan, but to increase the health span.
Right.
So I want to talk about what exactly you mean by that, and then how you go about achieving that.
The term health span has an interesting history. When investigators were first using yeast to study compounds which extended longevity, there was a very famous study out of Harvard on a red wine compound called resveratrol.
Yep. That 60 Minutes did a big story in like 91 or 2, and everybody went nuts, and red wine sales went crazy.
It was on Oprah.
It was everywhere.
Yeah, and it's a very interesting molecule. And resveratrol can be used to extend lifespan in yeast. And the targets, the proteins which resveratrol interacts with in humans, may or may not extend maximum lifespan in humans.
Yeah, before we can go on, just because I know some of our audience is going, wait, what did we learn with resveratrol? Correct me if I'm wrong. I thought we ended up learning down the line that red wine doesn't have enough of it to offer the benefit that was sort of initially hinted at.
That's true.
It was almost like, you know, how many bowls of colon blow? You remember the SNL cereal? Yeah. 30,000 bowls of your cereal to equal one bowl. It would be, you'd have to drink a lot of red wine to get the resveratrol.
I think this goes to the point of that I wanted to make, is that it's very difficult to study aging in humans. I mean, how are you going to run a clinical trial on extending lifespan? So there may not be enough resveratrol in red wine, but there's other compounds that may enhance resveratrol and other similar molecules in wine that may actually have some effect on longevity. But yeast has a very relatively short lifespan, and the targets of resveratrol and other small molecules or drug-like molecules that may extend lifespan are present in yeast, so you can study this process in yeast. The way that yeast age and die, when I first got into this field, it surprised me. Yeast age and die by many of the same mechanisms that humans age and die.
How? How long does yeast live?
So you want to talk about the replicative lifespan of yeast?
I've never been to the yeast assisted living homes, things like that. I have no idea what's normal.
Yeah.
So I think it gets to the idea of cellular health. And in yeast, there are ways to measure lifespan. One way is to measure what we call a replicative senescence type of experiment, where every time a yeast cell divides, there will be what we call a mother, and the daughter cell will be born, and it's sort of pinched off, budded, and the mother will be larger initially, so you can tell them apart, at least initially. And this was known in the 1950s. And the way that people studied this is they took a pin, and they were able to poke the daughter cell and move it to a different part of the Petri plate and follow exactly how many times the mother cell could do this division. And it turns out it's roughly like 40 times. And it takes about 90 minutes for each event. And they would do this for almost a week straight of measurements doing this. And every time the mother cell divided, they would put a check mark on a sheet of paper and keep an accounting of it. And it turns out in human cells and other higher cells, the animal cells, there is also like a replicative limit in culture. If you took a mouse and cultured its lungs, there is a limited division capacity that it can undergo. And probably at least some of that relates to the cellular health that is there. And then how that translates to the tissues and bodies, that maybe Dave could address some of that. But
yeah, I think one facet of this research that maybe we can focus on is relates to a molecule we've been studying, which affects DNA damage. A major theory, we still don't know. There's a lot of discussion and research on why we age and die. That's still not a done deal. But one of the major theories is the DNA damage theory of aging, and that as you get older, your genome, the DNA in the nucleus that encodes all your proteins, begins to accumulate damage. And at some point, that damage will lead to death. I think it's a simple way to state the DNA damage theory of lifespan. We've discovered a molecule that affects DNA damage in yeast, and we can tweak that. We can tweak that protein in two different ways. We can tweak it so that it increases DNA damage and shortens yeast lifespan, or we can tweak it in a way that it increases lifespan. So we can increase or decrease lifespan by playing with this protein, and this protein plays virtually the identical roles in human cells. And we know...
You know that.
We others have shown that. This has been studied for years and years and years. And there's many levels of evidence that support the DNA damage theory of aging. Older people accumulate more damage. There's these really tragic but remarkable syndromes called progeroid syndromes, where you'll see, I think most people have seen photographs of these kids. They may be 12, 13 years old, but they look like old people. Mm-hmm. Their tissues age very quickly. And some of these diseases are due to defects in the genes that regulate DNA damage and control. There's other theories of aging. Another molecule we've been focusing on, we have some evidence extends or is beneficial for longevity by targeting metabolism. And that's a huge field. As we age, we become not necessarily less efficient, but our metabolism shifts. And that leads to aging and age-associated diseases.
When we talk about the word damage, DNA damage, sort of a strange question, but how do you define damage?
Well, Greg's an expert in this. So.
Greg?
Oh, okay. So we mentioned the idea of genes too, right? And that your yeast have roughly 6,000 genes. Human have 20 to 30,000 genes. And the chromosomes, which are like our blueprint of information of what happens to make new cells. The genes are stretches of the chromosomes that tell the cell make a something called a protein. Many of them. Some of them don't. And so those proteins become the workers of the cell. And when a mutation occurs, either a subtle thing or just an absolute knockout, that protein can't be made in the same way. So it's as if the assembly line has just lost one of its important workers. And now it has to try to survive. And sometimes it can't. And so you can imagine this, if you accrue many of these changes genetically, you're going to start missing pieces, key pieces of the cell's machinery, its workforce.
Well, tell me if I'm making an incorrect assumption. I assume that breakdown in the assembly line, for which I think is a great metaphor, does that impact vision? Does that impact hearing? Pretty much anything that we can associate that gets worse as we get older, does that come from what we would call DNA damage that you're describing? Yes?
Short answer is that there's a term, you know, the age-associated diseases, that most diseases that humans are afflicted with are age-associated. You know, as you get older, you know, cancers, neurodegenerative diseases, Parkinson's, cardiovascular diseases.
Dementia,
right. Yeah. I was trying to remember that word. You know, wrinkling of skin, graying of hair, all sorts of age-associated diseases. And there's evidence in many of these that DNA damage plays a role. Maybe not the only role, and maybe we don't understand how some of these phenotypes, some of these age-associated diseases arise, but some of them definitely arise through DNA damage. And these progeroid syndromes give us good insight into that.
Yeah.
These people, their vision goes, cataracts get, you know,
which is thankfully not common at all, but does happen. Progeroid syndrome is what you called it. Is there anything approaching an opposite, or even are there cultures of people that tend to have less DNA damage at an earlier age? In other words, are there parts of our population that generally are healthier longer?
There are populations of people who live well into their hundreds, not populations, but there's groups. For instance, in the south of Italy, there's towns where there's a lot of centurions, a lot of people who live into their hundreds. And I don't, Greg, do you know whether they've actually assessed whether there's less DNA damage among these folk?
Yes, so that's ongoing thing now that with all the genome sequencing projects. That they're looking at octogenarians, centenarians, and they're looking for subtle changes in the DNA that will lead to subtle changes in the proteins. And maybe you could imagine, I don't know what the best analogy would be, but maybe say one of the proteins was a bodybuilder, and maybe one change gave him bigger muscles, and he was more able to carry out his job, right? Whereas other changes would produce normal people with less developed muscles, and it's the same thing in the cell. One of the interesting things I think that could be notable is that in these progeroid syndromes, they're finding that some of the things that are mutated, the proteins that are mutated, are actually involved in DNA repair. And so what happens is in those cases is it's like an escalation of mutations that occurs. More higher than maybe the normal rate, because the cells would mutate and there's a bunch of proteins that come in and fix those damages, But if those get taken out of the equation, then the cell, the mutation rate accelerates. And so that, and that seems to be what happens in what we know about the progeroid syndrome. Now, whether that's the opposite, we're still, the verdict is out on that, but it would be nice if there was a hypercapacity of DNA repair in the octogenarians and centenarians.
Sure. And you know, I think the one of the hard parts of study, I'm sure, is that there's so many variables in how we live, which is why studying yeast is way better than studying people. Because, you know, if Greg and I were twins and we, and I actually have a twin, and my twin and I did the exact same thing every day and ate the same food and went to the same places and tried to limit the variables, we'd probably still age just slightly differently, wouldn't we? I mean, even though our DNA is so similar, and I wonder if most of, well, I don't know if most, but if a lot of our age-related disease, if a lot of our DNA damage comes from hard living, life choices, environment, circumstances, versus what is naturally going to happen, all things sort of kept even. And is it, I guess, is it easier to study yeast than people that way, because yeast don't have the variables that people do? Is that fair?
I think we know very little about human aging. There's obviously twin studies going on. But
there's still a ton of variables, right?
Yeah, and you touched upon a key one, which is very important in promulgating or pushing this idea of a metabolic role in aging, and that's this notion of caloric restriction. Caloric restriction is a dietary regimen, and this regimen can extend the longevity of model organisms like yeast and mice and dogs and other animals. And basically the idea is you cut back, in the crudest form, you cut back on total caloric intake by maybe 30-35%. So you're very thin, there's fecundity problems, reproductive problems, but animals, including yeast that are on a calorically restricted diet, can actually live longer. So you and your brother, you know, might have slightly different diets.
They live longer on a calorically restricted diet?
Yes, they actually live longer. And another point I want to interject right now, yeah, is the complexity of aging. We're talking about aging genes and things like that.
Yeah.
If you take an animal, and if you look in mice where caloric restriction, there's reasonably robust evidence that caloric restriction works to extend lifespan, certainly to mitigate some age-associated diseases. And you look at, in total, all the expression of their genes in animals that are eating a really fattening diet, which ironically is called the Western diet, or calorically restricted, on a calorically restricted diet, and you compare how all 20,000 of their genes are expressed, it's like sand through your fingers. It's very difficult to find what we call a signature, because things like aging are, there's a vast network of genes all interacting. And if you tweak one or tweak another, that can affect the expression and function of hundreds of genes in each different tissue. So it's a very, very challenging problem.
All right, let me grab a quick phone call here. And I should mention, if you have any questions for what you're hearing in our monthly science roundtable, questions or comments, we're talking aging and yeast and the role yeast plays in the lab as they work toward therapies, drugs, and better understanding of how we age. You can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Wes in Honeyoy. Go ahead, Wes.
Hey, good afternoon, Dr. Gofog, Dr. Tomlin. Two questions quickly. Can you talk a little bit about the nutritional value of yeast? I noticed that more and more people are purchasing it from health food stores. So I don't know if it's the vitamins that's involved in it or the reaction to basically eating or putting yeast on certain kinds of food. And I guess a second question would be is that I'm always fascinated with teachers at the elementary level who use yeast products and do experiments with children. If you can think of one experiment outside of baking that most elementary teachers use to teach kids about yeast. If you can think of one experiment that is pretty simple that can be used at the elementary level, sure, let us know. Appreciate that.
And are you a teacher?
Is there a book at the elementary level that teachers can use.
Are you a teacher, Wes?
Been in administration for a long time, but yeah, taught back in the 80s.
Well, let me bloviate for a minute on, on yeast as food, and maybe we can come up with an experiment. Maybe CO2 production and bubbles and things like this or something.
But, and Wes, thanks for the phone call. I appreciate that.
Thank
Go
you,
ahead,
Wes.
Guys.
Thank you. Yeah. So I don't think Greg or I are experts on nutrition.
As yeast is nutrition.
But I know people use yeast because yeast are rich in, for example, B vitamins. So I was just in Australia, New Zealand, and they have, you know, things like Vegemite.
Vegemite,
and,
yeah.
Oh, you know, which is awful, by the way. Yeah, I've had it. I have Australian friends who've tried to tell me it's like peanut butter.
Yeah.
It's like peanut butter mixed with
salt.
Aleve. I mean, it's really just not appetizing.
Yeah, so I think, you know, yeast has a lot of micronutrients, and I think it might be beneficial in that way. I know that yeast is very rich in B vitamins, but other than that, I don't think I'd be confident to talk about yeast as a
sure.
food.
Now, on the experiment side, it's an interesting question because, again, I open the hour by saying most of us think of yeast for exactly what Wes is talking about, baking bread and things like that. But even at lower levels of education, is there anything basic that teachers can try, kids can try?
Well, I would interject. One advantage clearly is that yeast are safe, right? So you can buy it at the grocery store. And in the
cheap, right?
Dehydrated packs or a whole chunk if you'd like, and you can mix it with water and make bread and you know, you can make beer in a controlled way. And on a small scale, you can illustrate these metabolic properties of CO2 production.
I dare say you want to be producing ethanol in elementary school labs. If there's microscopes, there's a number of things that one could do with yeast. I think if the caller wanted to explore this more, if he just emailed Greg or I, we could put him refer him to various websites and pages that have experiments suitable for elementary school students.
Sure, and Wes, we're happy to hook you up. If you want to just email me, edawson@wxxi.org, we'll get you in touch with them. And hey, it's nice to hear from administrators who want to broaden the scientific language and experimentation. Let's get a short break, and when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about the patent. Reuters, by the way, determined that your patent is the most cited discovery to emerge from academic research in recent years. And I want to talk about just how quickly viable. I mean, one of the things when we talk in our monthly science roundtable about various desires to create new therapies, drugs, et cetera, whether it's aging or just about anything else, everyone sort of wants to know, good, when are you going to get it to market? You know, what's the process like? And the goal is always tomorrow, and that's never possible. But really, what is likely, what's possible as we talk about aging and what may come out of this kind of research? With David Goldfarb and Greg Tomblin from the University of Rochester, short break. We continue our monthly science roundtable next. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, peering into our past is a billion-dollar business with Ancestry.com and many others. You might have seen PBS's Genealogy Roadshow. Well, one of the stars is Kenyatta Barry. She's here for the hour. We're talking genealogy, understanding our roots, and why so many of us have become obsessed. We'll talk with you Tuesday.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Eastman School of Music, presenting the Toronto Symphony Orchestra, performing Bach and Shostakovich, featuring Peter Ungen conducting and Angela Hewitt on piano, Friday, April 15th at Kodak Hall at Eastman Theater. Tickets at eastmantheater.org.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and we're talking about yeast in the lab and yeast as a way of helping scientists and researchers understand aging better. And then the question becomes, well, how quickly can we do that? And David and Greg founded a biotech company. Does that have a name, David?
Its name was Calorix.
Okay.
Referring to caloric restriction.
Well, it was. Are we?
Now it's morphed into a company called Navator.
Okay. And the goal with the company is to do what?
Originally, the goal was to exploit a freezer full of small drug-like molecules that had beneficial effects on yeast longevity, lifespan, both healthy lifespan and also maximal lifespan. The company was founded, a local venture capitalist heard of our work and then introduced it to some Boston venture capitalists, and founded a company. The main goal was to pursue the mechanism of action of a very interesting family of small drug-like molecules that extended yeast lifespan, and as we had shown in other experiments, also seemed to have anti-inflammatory activity in mice and in other model systems, mammalian model systems, specifically mouse model systems for age-associated diseases. So that there was a lot of interest in, could this molecule be developed as an anti-aging compound?
Okay, and before I continue on that line of questions, let me just pivot for 1 second and ask, you mentioned the word inflammation for the first time this hour, and this is where a little bit of knowledge is probably dangerous, but a lot of what I read is that inflammation is at the root of a lot of evils of what is hurting us, what is causing aging. But Greg, DNA damage is not synonymous with inflammation. Is that correct?
No, that's correct.
Okay.
But there's some evidence that it might elicit inflammation or an inflammatory response. So that's a very active area, I would say, and people that are working on mammalian systems now.
And cells which senesce, and this is something right. that Greg is actually involved in right now, cells that senesce produce a lot of inflammatory signals. So aging, older cells are highly inflammatory, I think.
Okay. These are some of the goals in this company. And to create, I guess, we talked about therapies and drugs. How do we do that? What are the steps that have to happen before you can do that?
So the path we took was to, and this was a very, considered a very early stage company because the risk-benefit analysis suggested that there's a huge upside to pursuing the molecules we had discovered using yeast replicative lifespan. The goal was to identify how that small molecule was doing what it did in yeast, and then to determine as a next step, is it doing the same thing in mammalian cells? And if it's doing the same thing in mammalian cells, the next step would be to find an appropriate disease model in an organism like mouse that has the livers and kidneys and age-associated diseases and look for efficacy in a mouse model. So we spent several years trying to identify the mechanism of action of this small molecule, how it was entering the yeast cell and altering its metabolism to affect its longevity. And unfortunately, we never actually figured out what's called the singular target of how this molecule was operating. That's good news, bad news. It's bad news in that it's very difficult to develop a drug without knowing what protein it's binding to, so you can get and very intelligently study how that molecule is binding to that protein and study the protein's biology. On the other side, it suggests that we may have come across quite a novel anti-aging mechanism that will require a lot more basic biology before we begin to understand how it's affecting aging. Because as I've already alluded to, there's still a lot we don't know about how organisms age.
So what's happening right now then? Go ahead, Greg.
So, yeah, I just wanted to hark back to the patent and also to just show the elegance of what it was all about and how we used it. And that is that, if you remember, I mentioned the way that they measured yeast lifespan 50 years ago, and they still use this as a way. They manually move the daughter cells over to a different side and count the number of divisions. And if you imagine that if you were to do that for 6,000 different mutant strains and maybe do 100 cells at a time for each to get good statistics, that would take years of work and hundreds of students and postdocs as like an army. And this experiment was actually done by a collaborator we know. But so what Dave's experiment and method that we developed was that we could do this kind of a replicative measure in tiny plates, 100 at a time, and almost have a robot do it. And so this is the idea, is that it enables a very high throughput approach to finding molecules that would have some biological activity.
I think I want to extend that to say that the experiment that led to this patent involved within a couple of weeks screening almost 200,000 small molecules for their effect on yeast using robots. So going from one individual who could maybe quantify or measure the lifespan of 8 yeast strains, each yeast in the presence of a different drug-like molecule, we could screen an entire library of tens and tens and tens of thousands of drug-like molecules and then identify which of those molecules had beneficial effects. And that experiment led to the identification of, I think, 140 drug-like molecules, and that's what the basis of this patent is a description of that method for screening chemical libraries for small molecules that extend lifespan, and also the list of those molecules.
And so what Dave was saying about a target, so when you have a gene and you have the sequence of the genome and you knock out the gene, you know the thing that you're affecting. And when you add a small molecule to a cell, you don't really know how it's working, what it's binding to directly. And what we imagine is it might, the all likelihood based on other people's success with small molecules is that they have an inactivating effect, that it might be equivalent to a knockout. The thing that with a small molecule is that it may be more subtle than just completely knocking out a gene or a protein, right? So it will bind to the protein worker and then affect that activity somehow. And that's the idea behind the small molecule target. And it's very difficult to identify sometimes what that is. And so that's the other advantage of using yeast, is that we can do biochemistry experiments where we can squash up the yeast, grow a million of them in a tube, squash them up, and then put our molecule on a solid surface and see what yeast proteins or things in that cell bind to that molecule. And we tried to do that, and we had a number of leads to follow. So sometimes it just involves a lot of validation then. But the beauty of the yeast is that you can do those things quickly. I think maybe Dave would also wanted to mention the idea of a chemical genetic effect, which relates to the ability of target ID.
Okay. Yeah. So this is one of the advantages of yeast. And to date, it's maybe a unique advantage is you can look for effects of your molecule in thousands and thousands and thousands of different yeast strains. Greg has used this term strain, which is basically all the strains or all the yeasts in each little tube are identical except for the loss of one gene. So an analogy is, I think if I use an analogy, maybe this process, because it's a remarkable tool. Imagine you take a car, and you've never seen a car before, and you have no idea how a car works, and you take it out to the desert, and you disassemble it. And I looked it up this morning. A typical car has 30,000 parts in it. So you can line up all these parts and say, okay, let's go back and take 30,000 automobiles. Of course, this is impractical, but in yeast you can do this. You have 30,000 automobiles, and in each automobile you remove that part, and you test drive those cars. Very quickly you can determine which are the essential parts, the parts that if you take them out the car doesn't work. But
you need the wheels.
Well, but you can take one wheel off,
right?
So there's redundant functions built into the system.
Okay,
that's a really good point. But then you're also going to find, probably, I would guess, out of 30,000 parts, you're going to find 20,000-25,000 parts that you can remove
and still drive.
Yeah, and you can do the same thing in yeast. I think there's 6,000 genes in yeast, and about 5,000 of them are non-essential. You can knock them out, and in the laboratory setting, if you put them out in nature, they wouldn't be able to survive.
Sure.
But in the laboratory setting, they can survive and grow. Sometimes they're a little sick. Sometimes they're perfectly fine. What you can then do in yeast, and this is a method which was championed by an investigator named Charlie Boone in Toronto, which was a massive effort, and he and his group pulled this off beautifully. You take each one of those 30,000 cars and then go back into each one of those cars and remove all 29,000 other parts one at a time. So all of a sudden you're dealing with millions and millions and millions of cars. Well, you can do this with yeast. And you can ask, if you remove this part and it has no effect, what happens if you remove that part and another part?
Mm-hmm. Right. So combinations that on their own might not be a big deal. You take out a combination of parts, you're in trouble.
Right. And what we can do in yeast is we can add our small molecule, which in our hands, we're working with small molecules which are non-toxic, and ask, if we remove each 6,000 genes one at a time, does that molecule start to affect the growth of that yeast?
And so just like Dave was saying about the car tires that you said, you can remove one of the four, but maybe you can't remove two of the four. So a lot of times when this synthetic effect, this more than additive effect comes into play, it targets a certain pathway. It targets a certain mechanism that is revealed suddenly. So by that, we may be able to infer what the unknown target is.
In this case, it's how the car moves, how it rolls, right? If you get to the electrical system, or you get to the pistons or the fuel injectors, you'll find that all the pieces that, when you remove together, cause problems, those all may fit into one particular part of the car. And that's what we find with our small molecules, is that when we add our small molecule to different cells, we may not see an effect. And when we start removing other parts one at a time, we may identify 10, 12 genes that, when removed together, start to really cause the cells to be sick in the presence of our molecule. Whereas in healthy cells, normal cells, there's no effect. And then we look at what those genes are, and lo and behold, they may be involved in lipid metabolism or DNA metabolism. And then we know, aha, our small molecule is acting in that pathway. It's a very, very powerful approach. A
listener named Jake writes and says, the methods that they're talking about were just used to create the smallest synthetic genome that created a living bacteria with 400 or so genes. Is that correct?
So Craig Venter's group has taken a bacterium, which is not a eukaryote. It's a much simpler organism. And they're trying to engineer the smallest possible genome that allows life. So they systematically removed genes. And some of them were redundant, some of them weren't. It's a whole story, but it's a similar sort of process. I have to say, though, that the work in yeast, to do this in yeast, is much simpler than it is in the bacterial system, even though bacteria are simpler, because of the genetics of yeast allow investigators to do this much more quickly.
Our car analog, then, would be a car that can move like the Flintstones, right? Like creating the car that needs the fewest amount of parts to actually be able to move. You know, that's what you've been able to strip it down backwards to. Okay, but then we've had a lot of very interesting analogies there. I give these guys credit. But before we lose the hour, you know, this is, to me, again, not someone who's not a scientist, but it's exciting to hear about what you've been able to start doing. And then the question becomes, again, when it comes to actual therapies and drugs, what's the best case scenario? What's the best case scenario that comes out of the success you've had so far in this process?
I think I'd like to talk about another molecule we're working on.
Yeah.
This molecule, ironically, was discovered because it shortened yeast lifespan. I've already alluded to this one before. But by studying the situation more, we found that if we've identified a target, a protein that plays a role in DNA metabolism, and it plays a role such that it causes DNA damage, that in young yeast, and I'm guessing quite strongly that in young people, that DNA damage is efficiently repaired. That there's repair systems, little nanobots that go in there and repair that damage very efficiently in young people. But as you age, those repair systems begin to decline, and now that damage causes a problem.
Right, because DNA damage doesn't just happen when we get older. It's happening, but we are repairing it.
Exactly.
From what we understand, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So what we did was we took the protein target that we thought was causing damage, and this protein is required for life. The damage that it causes is kind of a byproduct of a very essential, very important function that it has. It breaks both strands of the DNA. And if that persists, you're in trouble. So there's very robust repair systems to repair it. What I think a good plan would be to come up with a small molecule that reduces the activity of that protein to a level which still allows normal functions of the cell. And we've done this in yeast. Still allows normal functions of the cell. But later in life, it causes less damage that can still be handled by the decrepit DNA repair systems. And I think Greg mentioned earlier, it's much easier to screw something up than it is to make it more active. So here's a situation where we can come with a molecule that kind of removes the function of that, decreases the function of that enzyme. Then that molecule may well lead directly to a drug in that you that only older people would have to take.
Sure. So a molecule that eventually becomes part of a drug that we can take orally?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I would add too, I think what Dave said is awesome, that our work found this protein that has been known for 40 years. And no one appreciated its role in aging via its DNA repair activities. And that was novel. But I wanted to add, too, you had like a general question about how it would affect treatment of diseases and aging and maybe other things, is that these systems, these approaches, will allow us to identify novel targets in ways that we didn't appreciate before in a rapid way. And I think what I wanted to mention, too, was that our ability to analyze other people's data with a computer and put our data in that context, like, for instance, the sequencing of all these octogenarians or centenarians, do we find things that give a trend and then fit these pathways into things that will affect overall health and aging? And that's the idea, is to that we're going to reveal novel things that maybe weren't appreciated using a rapid yeast method.
And about 30 seconds, David, go ahead.
I think your question was how close are we to, you know,
sure.
we're talking 5, 10, 15 years.
Sure.
But there are other groups at other biotech companies and universities that have even natural products that they've identified that play a role in metabolism that when given to animals extends their lifespan. So these natural products are much more easily to get approved through FDA, and we may be seeing these things in a very few years that affect life, age-associated diseases, and lifespan.
Well, we've learned a lot this hour, and really remarkable from start to finish what we're able to do with yeast and what we might be able to do long-term. But this is just another check mark in that category. If someone told me, if you can live another 40 years, you'll live another 120. You know, I don't know if that's exactly right, but these are the days I think that somebody was onto something there. David Goldfarb is a professor of biology at the University of Rochester. Greg Tomblin is a research associate in the Department of Biology at the U of R. Thanks to you both, and continued good work. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your work.
Yeah. It's our monthly science roundtable. Thanks to Valerie LaBanca, the engineer of the broadcast, Marielle Brinkerhoff, who does the great work for us, our intern for the semester, and Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson, and we will talk with you Tuesday on Member Supported Public Radio.